content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 21st issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. A new Supreme Court challenge for Obamacare. What happened? The future of the Affordable Care Act was again thrown into question last week when the U.S. Supreme Court announced it would hear a potentially devastating challenge to the law. The case revolves around a single sentence in the 906-page law that authorizes federal subsidies to help low- and middle-income Americans afford private health insurance, a provision utilized by 4.7 million Americans in the ACA's first year. The Republican-backed plaintiffs argue that because the law says these tax credits are to be distributed through a health care exchange established by the state, residents in the 36 states that decline to set up their own exchanges, leaving the federal government to run them instead, should not be eligible. The sloppy wording, which Democrats call a drafting error, apparently slipped through as congressional staffers raced to reconcile several versions of the law just before its final passage. The Obama administration says that to read that passage literally runs contrary to the spirit of the law, and the Internal Revenue Service has concurred, ruling that both state and federal-run exchanges can issue subsidies. At least four justices voted to take the case, King versus Burwell. It poses the biggest threat to Obamacare since 2012, when Chief Justice John Roberts unexpectedly sided with the Supreme Court's four liberal justices to declare the law a constitutional tax. The court is expected to hear arguments and render a ruling by June 2015. What the editorial said. Most federal judges who have considered this claim have tossed it out, and for good reason, said the New York Times. The overriding aim of the ACA is to make health insurance as widely available as possible. It's inconceivable that conservative justices would use a contorted reading of four words to destroy a landmark law that has provided health care coverage to millions of Americans for the first time. If they deny subsidies to those 36 states, young, healthy people who can't afford their coverage without the tax subsidy would drop out, and insurance markets would go into a death spiral. The law says what it says. So the question is whether this administration can unilaterally rewrite the law to suit its political ends, said the Wall Street Journal. One of the architects of the ACA, Jonathan Gruber, has publicly acknowledged that the text was deliberately worded to give the states an incentive to set up their own exchanges. Only later did Democrats decide their incentive has become politically inconvenient. What the columnist said. Liberals are right to say that this was probably just a drafting error, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. But when Chief Justice Roberts deemed ACA constitutional on a technicality, ruling that it was essentially a tax, liberals crowed at their victory and reminded their opponents to respect the rule of law, whether they liked the outcome or not. Now the shoe is on the other foot. Just because the court took the case doesn't mean Roberts will vote to destroy Obamacare, said Barry Friedman and Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. A 5-4 ruling to ignore Congress's intent, based on a technicality, would be politically toxic for Republicans. There's a big political difference between denying people a benefit they never received and taking away a benefit that has made millions of lives immeasurably better. In fact, yanking away health insurance will kill people, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Without tax subsidies, many very sick people will be unable to afford crucial ongoing treatment and they will become collateral damage in the right's larger ideological war. Is there any conservative who will admit this? If Roberts casts the deciding once again, which way will he swing? Asked Noah Feldman in BloombergView.com. It's very possible four conservatives took this case to put Roberts to the test. Having been branded a traitor by Republicans over his 2012 ruling, he might this time want to go along with the conservative tide. But it's also possible Roberts will stick to his guns rather than see the court assume responsibility for crippling Obamacare. Stand by for a long 6 months of speculation. A second main story, China's climate pledge. The U.S. and China made a breakthrough climate change deal this week after Beijing, for the first time, agreed to specific limits on its future greenhouse gas emissions. Under the joint agreement, announced by President Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing, China will reach peak carbon emissions in 2030 and aim to get 20% of its energy from zero carbon emission sources by the same year. The U.S. pledged to double the pace of its carbon cuts and reduce emissions 26% to 28% below their 2005 levels by 2025. This is a major milestone in the U.S.-China relationship, said Obama. Senator Mitch McConnell, who represents the coal-producing state of Kentucky, slammed the deal, saying it requires the Chinese to do nothing at all for 16 years while these carbon emission regulations are creating havoc in the U.S. Something really significant has just happened in Beijing, said Bruce Einhorn in BusinessWeek.com. The Chinese president's commitment to cut emissions is a sign his government is already making progress in shrinking its CO2 output. Otherwise, Xi wouldn't risk the embarrassment. Even better, other countries that have been historically reluctant to make carbon cuts will no longer be able to use Chinese inaction as a convenient excuse. Don't hold your breath, said David Nakamura in the Washington Post. In order for the U.S. to meet its side of the deal, the Obama White House and the next administration will have to overcome staunch Republican opposition to achieve meaningful carbon cuts. Meanwhile, China will have to match the production of existing coal plants with nuclear, wind, solar energy in the run-up to 2030. A big ask for a country that completes a new coal plant every 8 to 10 days. The Communist Party doesn't have a choice if it wants to survive, said James Fallows in TheAtlantic.com. China's repressive political system might seem resilient, but when children are developing lung cancer, when people in the capital city die 5 years too early on average because of air pollution, and when crops and water supplies are regularly poisoned, that system just won't last. Our controversy of the week, immigration. Should Obama go it alone? We should have known that mere election results wouldn't deter our imperial president, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. In the wake of his party's drubbing last week in the midterm elections, President Obama arrogantly informed victorious Republicans that unless they swiftly pass an immigration bill that I can sign, he'll issue executive orders before January 1st that grant temporary work visas to millions of illegal immigrants. Now, if Obama really believes in amnesty, he could have barnstormed the country to sell it to Americans during the election campaign. But he's too unpopular to campaign with Democrats, let alone convince anyone of anything. So instead, he is resorting to executive blackmail and defying the Constitution, which gives Congress authority over immigration law. This could be a big, big deal, said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. Unilateral action by Obama would enrage the incoming GOP-controlled Congress, poison the well, as House Speaker John Boehner put it, and trigger an all-out Republican attempt to block Obama's decision. The conservative entertainment complex will be incendiary, whipping up a constitutional crisis. Get ready for a titanic battle. Mr. President, issue the executive order, said Jonathan Capehart, also in WashingtonPost.com. After a bipartisan reform bill passed by the Senate, died last year in the House, it would be foolish for Obama to expect the new Congress to do anything on immigration. Will executive action infuriate the Republicans? Of course. But if you're going to get folks mad, it may as well be in the service of helping people who are trapped in a broken system. The president has no choice but to ask, said Shika Dalmia in Reason.com. When he backed off an earlier pledge to issue an executive order by the end of the summer, immigration activists took it as a grave betrayal, and it probably contributed to the low Hispanic turnout in the midterm elections. If Obama breaks his word again, the 2016 election will be an even bigger debacle for Democrats. Actually, said Ruth Marcus in WashingtonPost.com, unilateral action by Obama could backfire politically. It would end any chance he and Congress could cooperate on other issues as well. In 2016, Republicans will try to blame continued gridlock on Obama's provocation, and the public may be inclined to believe them. Even if Obama's unconstitutional intervention pleases Hispanics, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com, it will enrage millions of Americans and motivate them to vote in the next election. Democrats should have learned this year that playing to their base and ignoring the rest of the voters is a recipe for defeat. Why do people in Washington think this is some political game, said Ruben Navarrete in CNN.com. It isn't, at least not for the millions of mothers and fathers toiling away in farm fields, construction sites, and restaurant kitchens in an agonizing limbo, worrying they'll be snatched away from their children. Obama may say the right things about immigration reform, but he has deported 2 million people. Now, there are rumors he may issue temporary work visas to 1 million or 2 million of the 11 million who lack legal status, rather than suspend deportations entirely. If Republicans don't want Obama to act on his own, they should stop demagoguing and pass reform legislation through the Congress they now control. As with the White House, Republicans are out of excuses. Their stalling has worn thin, and the hour is late. It was a good week for giant leaps for mankind. After a European Space Agency satellite successfully landed a probe onto a speeding comet 300 million miles from Earth, the first time that's ever been done. It was a good week for test drives after a New York plastic surgeon introduced a temporary breast enhancement procedure he dubbed vacation breasts. Dr. Norman Rowe says the injections of saline solution are perfect for special occasions, such as a wedding or vacation. It was a good week for the power of incumbency after a state senator in Washington won re-election despite being deceased. Democrat Roger Freeman, 48, died 6 days before the election after battling cancer. This is extremely rare, a state official said. It was a bad week for showboating after Utah wide receiver Kalen Clay dropped the football before crossing the goal line as he celebrated what would have been a 79-yard touchdown. Oregon defenders picked up the ball and returned it 99 yards for a touchdown. It was a bad week for Google searches after the website Breitbart.com breathlessly reported that Attorney General nominee Loretta Lynch served on the Clinton's defense team during the Whitewater case. The site later admitted that it was a different attorney with the same name. It was a bad week for diplomatic overtures after Russian President Vladimir Putin draped a blanket over the shoulders of the wife of Chinese President Xi Jinping at a state dinner, as Xi was chatting with President Obama. Chinese media censored the video, apparently fearing it made Putin look manlier and more attentive than Z. On the briefing page, surviving Ebola. Thousands are dying from the viral disease in Africa. Why are patients treated in the U.S. recovering? What is Ebola's mortality rate? It largely depends on where patients are treated. In the current outbreak in West Africa, about 70% of the 13,000 people infected have died. But of the 9 confirmed cases in the U.S., a mix of medical volunteers who returned from Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, and the health workers who caught the disease treating them here, there has been just one fatality, Liberian national Thomas Eric Duncan. 8 patients were successfully treated and discharged, including Dr. Craig Spencer, who left Bellevue Hospital in New York City this week. Thus far, the mortality rate of Ebola patients treated in the U.S. is 11%, and it might be zero had Duncan's treatment not been delayed because of a misdiagnosis when he first went to the hospital in Dallas. An Ebola infection is not a death sentence, said Michael Buchmeier, a virologist at the University of California at Irvine. It's a beatable disease. Why is treatment in the U.S. working? American hospitals have superior facilities, equipment, and staffing. When a patient starts suffering from severe vomiting and diarrhea, it is imperative that his or her lost fluids, up to 5 gallons a day, are replaced via an IV drip to prevent organ failure and shock. Doctors here are well equipped to do that and can also carefully monitor and adjust electrolyte levels in the blood. Chemicals such as potassium, magnesium, and sodium that can plummet with fluid loss. In a Liberian field hospital, IV lines, saline solution, and monitoring equipment are in short supply. American physicians have also had access to the experimental antiviral drug ZMAP and blood serum from patients who've developed antibodies to Ebola. They can use a huge array of drugs for treating other symptoms, such as abdominal pain and low blood pressure. If necessary, doctors can bring in ventilators and dialysis machines to keep struggling patients alive long enough for their immune systems to fight off the disease. What about staffing levels? In the U.S., there are 245.2 doctors per 100,000 people. In Liberia, it's just 1.4, or about 60 in total. So when Rick Sakra, a missionary, was being treated for Ebola in Liberia, he saw a doctor only once a day. But after being evacuated to the Nebraska Medical Center, one of 4 U.S. hospitals with biocontainment units designed for treating infectious disease patients, he received round-the-clock care from more than 40 highly trained health workers, including a nurse permanently stationed in his room. None of this came cheaply. Insurance companies estimate that treating an Ebola patient can cost up to $25,000 a day. In Sierra Leone, where annual health care spending is just $205 per capita, that level of care is not possible. There's no magic going on, says infectious disease expert Dr. Bruce Farber. The supportive care in the U.S. is just incredibly different. How else is it different here? Most of the U.S. patients began treatment at the first sign of infection. In West Africa, so many patients have died in Ebola treatment centers that people fear them and thus do not get medical help until they're gravely ill, at which point their organs are failing and their viral load is too large for their bodies to fight off. American hospitals are also much better at preventing the spread of infection to their health workers. When Atlanta's Emory Hospital became overwhelmed by the amount of Ebola-contaminated waste, it immediately installed an industrial-sized autoclave, which uses pressure and 275-degree heat to sterilize any kind of material. Field hospitals in West Africa tend not to have autoclaves. Can West African care be improved? Yes, but it will take more equipment, facilities, doctors, and money. The U.S. is sending 3,900 troops to shore up infrastructure in the region, with the initial aim of building 17 Ebola treatment centers with 100 beds each. But it may be hard to staff them. The high infection rate among health workers, 310 have died since the outbreak began last December, is deterring foreign volunteers. Understaffing is now such a problem that only 22% of the planned 4,707 treatment center beds in West Africa are operational. The personnel is a critical factor, said Dr. Gino Strada, founder of the nonprofit group Emergency. For a 100-bed hospital, he said, you need 100 nurses and 10 to 15 doctors. Is there any hope of a cure? A few treatments have certainly shown promise. Patients who were given the experimental drug ZMapp, which did exceptionally well in animal trials, showed an immediate improvement. However, two of the seven recipients eventually died. Blood transfusions from Ebola survivors may have helped some patients, and researchers have begun a number of trials for potential vaccines. But until a medical breakthrough is made, the keys to fighting Ebola on both sides of the Atlantic are resources and manpower. You need the four S's, said Paul Farmer, co-founder of the aid group Partners in Health: staff, stuff, space, and systems. In our column reading this week, we're going to take one from Europe, one from Pakistan, and then a business column. First from Europe, how they see us. Moving away from European values. Something is broken in the American political system, said Alain Franchon in Le Monde from France. The Republicans who swept both houses of Congress in last week's midterm elections ran an entirely negative campaign. Everything wrong with the world was President Obama's fault, from Ebola in Africa to the jihadists in Iraq. At home, the U.S. economic recovery that makes Europe pale with envy was dismissed as insufficient. The Republicans offered no vision of their own other than to slash taxes and gut environmental protections. Why would American voters reward such a message? Most of them didn't. They stayed home. The vote was effectively won by the omnipresent, unlimited, corrosive impact of money, donations by big business to the GOP. And that party refuses to participate in democracy, which requires compromise for the good of all, instead of insisting on its own way or nothing. Money has utterly warped American politics, said Massimo Gaggi in the Corriere della Sera from Italy. In most European countries, the government funds political campaigning. But in the U.S., the Republicans have set up new financing mechanisms that allow them to use the most unscrupulous way the generous donations of the right-wing billionaires. Faced with a hostile Congress that is in the pocket of ultra-rich bankers and industrialists, Obama won't be able to pass the tax reforms and spending increases that are needed to tackle soaring income inequality. The country is now wallowing in pessimism. Americans may not love the Republicans, but they are disappointed in Obama's broken promises and his lack of leadership on the international stage. The rest of the world still loves Obama, though, said Jason Beatty in the Daily Mirror from the UK. America's reputation has soared across the world since he took over. People admire the president's integrity and statesmanship, and world leaders jostle for a meeting with him, hoping the old Obama charm will rub off. So let that be a hope for the battered president. He can look overseas to rescue his final reputation and his lasting legacy. Don't count on it, said Reinhard Goerl in Wiener Zeitung from Austria. The Republicans are now effectively the ruling party in the U.S., and they will set foreign policy. Expect the rhetoric against Russia to sharpen, antagonizing President Vladimir Putin to the detriment of the European Union. It's time for Europeans to recognize that their interests are not always the same as America's. After all, the EU model is fundamentally different not only from Putin's autocracy, but also from the free market radicalism of today's Republicans. This is a party that believes government-fueled health care is not a basic right, government-funded health care is not a basic right, but somehow an affront to freedom. Instead of relying on the U.S. to lead, the EU will have to forge its own separate path. This from Pakistan, where Christians live in fear of lynch mobs. The murder of a Christian couple accused of blasphemy is a tragedy that indicts all of Pakistan, said Muhammad Hassan Miraj in Dawn. Shahzad Masih and his pregnant wife, Shema, were modern-day slaves, indentured servants bound from childhood to work off a debt at a brick factory outside of Lahore. They are dead, and their three children orphaned because of a rumor that they burned a Quran while disposing of trash. The kiln owner locked them in his office while clerics used the local mosque's loudspeaker to denounce the couple and whip up a mob. Some 1,200 men from surrounding neighborhoods showed up, equipped with hockey sticks, rods, crowbars, and a blind, terrifying rage. They beat the couple to death and burned their bodies in the very kiln where the two had toiled all their lives. As is so often true in blasphemy cases, the alleged Quran desecration was just a pretext to hide the real motive for murder, said Hassan Javid in The Nation. Pakistan's human rights commissions say Shahzad was killed in a monetary dispute. He had apparently introduced the kiln owner to two Muslim laborers, and after the two absconded with advance wages, the owner demanded that Shahzad pay him the money they stole. When he refused, the kiln owner made up the blasphemy allegation. It's the same story over and over. An opportunistic charlatan levels charges against some powerless religious minority, and then hundreds of Pakistanis heed calls for mob violence, even though these very same people might condemn acts of cruelty and evil in other contexts. This bloodshed is fueled by Pakistan's blasphemy laws, says Murtaza Haidir in Dawn. People found guilty of insulting Islam can be sentenced to death, and rampaging mobs like the one that killed the Masihs think they're simply speeding up the judicial process. The law is just part of the problem, said Ayaz Amir in The News International. Lynch mobs are outside the law after all. Pakistan is simply unable to fulfill its primary responsibility of protecting the life, honor, and property of its citizen. We've seen many instances of violent mobs torching Christian neighborhoods while the police do nothing, or even participate. Just a day after the couple was killed, a policeman in another town axed to death a prisoner accused of blasphemy. In 2011, Salim Taseer, the governor of Punjab, who crusaded against the blasphemy law and defended Christians, was assassinated by his bodyguard. A large part of society, including lawyers and professionals, hailed his killer as an Islamic hero, showering him with rose petals at his trial. Lynch mobs don't arise unless many people feel they can get away with murder. And in Pakistan, apparently, they can. From the business page, the issue of the week, the great wage slowdown. The labor market may finally be hitting its stride, said Eric Marath in the Wall Street Journal. October marked the 49th straight month of U.S. job growth, the longest stretch of job creation since at least World War II. Employers added 214,000 new jobs to their payrolls, and August and September's job numbers were revised up, pushing the unemployment rate down to 5.8%, closer to a level many economists consider healthy. The size of the labor force grew as well, said Matt O'Brien in WashingtonPost.com, which means that unemployment fell for the good reason that people were finding work and not the bad one that they were giving up. 5 years on, the recovery appears to be ever so slightly speeding up. Too bad most Americans can't feel it, said the New York Times in an editorial. Since 2009, the economy has grown by 12%, corporate profits by 46%, and the broad stock market by 92%. But median household income has actually contracted 3%. Job gains simply haven't translated into higher pay. 65% of the private sector jobs created in the last 5 years have paid hourly wages of $20 or less. Last month was no different, with job growth concentrated in low-wage sectors like restaurants, retail, and temporary work. Americans might take home a little more dough now and then by working more hours or saving money on falling gas prices, but they are not getting ahead in any real sense. The economy is doing better on paper, but it's still not working for those who rely on paychecks to make a living. Bosses don't feel the need to offer raises because they aren't struggling to find workers to fill available jobs, said Allison Schrager in Bloomberg Businessweek. Millions of people who have been unemployed for many months or who are working in part-time or low-paying jobs because they can't find anything else stand at the ready to replace workers, and pay won't increase until this so-called slack in the labor market is absorbed. It's hard to predict when that will happen, but unemployment will probably have to fall a good deal more before it does. In truth, not all workers are losing, said Derek Thompson in TheAtlantic.com. Mining and energy jobs, for instance, have had a fantastic few years, while retail and food service wage growth has been awful. The problem is that we're adding lots of jobs in industries with stagnant wages and very few jobs in those with rising pay. In the run-up to the 2016 presidential election, the central question will be how both parties respond to the great wage slowdown, said David Leonhardt in NYTimes.com. In the meantime, Washington could definitely do more to help economic growth. Better infrastructure, a less burdensome tax code, a less wasteful healthcare system. Yet no mix of these policies is likely to end wage stagnation anytime soon. A more immediate fix would be a middle-class tax cut. That wouldn't be a cure-all and might even temporarily worsen some of the country's economic problems. But after years of disappointing pay, many voters are eager for a simple solution that can help people immediately. Turn now to our in-depth article, The Last Word. Titled this week, The Queen of Tupperware. Single mom Brownie Wise helped build a plastics empire, said Jen Dahl. One house party at a time. On an unseasonably warm day in April 1954, hundreds of women in cowboy hats gathered outside Tupperware's Florida headquarters to dig for buried treasure. It was the pinnacle of the inaugural Tupperware Jubilee, a five-day gold rush-themed affair celebrating all things Tupperware. For 5 hours that day, the women, a collection of dealers, distributors, and sales managers, prospected for mink stoles and freezer units, gold watches, and diamond rings. One of them, Faye Macalupo of Buffalo, dug up a toy car. When she saw the real Ford it represented, she planted her face against the hood and began to weep, repeating, "I love everybody." Presiding over the treasure hunt was the general sales manager of the Tupperware Home Parties division, a 40-year-old woman named Brownie Wise. For hours, she cheered on the ladies from a loudspeaker with an air of royalty. As she watched them hop on shovels and unearth the rewards of their labors, she couldn't help feeling proud. The story of the ubiquitous plastic container is a story of innovation and reinvention. How a new kind of plastic, made from an industrial waste material, ended up a symbol of female empowerment. The product ushered women into the workforce, encouraging them to make their own money, better their families, and win accolades and prizes without fear of being branded that 1950s anathema, the career woman. And all of it was because of Wise. Named for her big brown eyes, Brownie Wise was born in rural Georgia. Her parents divorced when she was young, and as a teen she traveled with her mother, who organized union rallies. Wise started giving speeches at her mother's rallies and proved to be a gifted and motivating orator. She awed people, writes Bob Keeling in his biography, Tupperware Unsealed. Wise was married briefly, but by 27 she was a divorced single mom in suburban Detroit. During World War II, she worked as a secretary at Bendix Aviation, a company that made parts for Navy torpedo planes. It was a decent but unfulfilling job. What Wise did possess was an endless fountain of determination. As she wrote in a journal at the time, I wanted to be a successful human being. It all started with a bad door-to-door salesman. When a Stanley Home Products salesman knocked on her door and proceeded to deliver a terrible sales pitch for cleaning supplies, Wise scoffed that she could do better. At the time, Stanley was experimenting with a peculiar sales model, home parties. A New Hampshire mop salesman had watched his numbers fly through the roof after he invited a bunch of women over for a party that included a mop demonstration. The company encouraged other salesmen to try the strategy, but many of them delegated the hosting to their wives. Thinking it'd be a fun side job, Wise started selling Stanley products at parties too. Before long, she was making enough money to quit her job at Bendix. Wise first glimpsed Tupperware at a sales meeting. One of her co-workers had seen the products gathering dust in a department store and decided to bring them in. At first, Wise didn't think they were anything special. But when she accidentally knocked a Tupperware bowl off the table, she realized its full potential. Instead of breaking, it bounced. It seemed like magic. Tupperware was unlike any home product she'd seen. It was attractive, coming in pastel colors and flexible shapes, almost like art. More important, it was functional. No other competing product even came close. Convinced of its potential, Wise traded in her Stanley brooms in 1949 and started throwing parties to sell Tupperware. What she didn't intend, exactly, was to kindle a revolution. The most amazing thing about Tupperware wasn't that it extended the life of leftovers in a family's budget, although it did both remarkably well. It was, above all, a career maker. Wise was such a charming host that she persuaded many buyers to also become Tupperware salespeople. And the more parties Wise hosted, the more tricks she learned to convert women into Tupperware faithful. Putting people on waiting lists, for instance, made them more eager to buy. She also discovered that throwing containers full of liquid across the room made customers reach straight for their checkbooks. By October 1949, she had 19 recruits, enough to move her supplies out of her house and into a larger warehouse. Wise's team in Detroit was selling more Tupperware than most department stores. This soon attracted the attention of the no-nonsense founder of the Tupperware Corporation, Earl Silas Tupper. Tupperware, true to its name, was Tupper's masterpiece, and he was counting on it to make his dreams come true. Having grown up in a poor Massachusetts farm family, he had vowed to make $1 million by the time he was 30. He hadn't. He did have a host of esoteric inventions, among them a fish-powered boat and a no-drip ice cream cone under his belt. But with a wife and family to support, he'd concentrated on a practical career in plastics. First at DuPont, and then at a company of his own, which made parts for Jeeps and gas masks during World War II. When the war ended, Tupper decided to buy cheap surpluses left over from wartime manufacturing. He figured he'd be able to do something with them. That's how he ended up with a glob of greasy black polyethylene, a smelly waste product left behind when metal is created from ore. Tupper took it and, after months of trial and error, wrangled the slag into submission, creating a lightweight plastic that refused to break. Tupper dubbed it Poly-T, and taking inspiration from the way paint cans sealed, created a flexible container with a noiseless lid that snapped on. He called the box Tupperware. The only problem, he couldn't get anyone to buy it. At least not until Wise came along. Her sales record was remarkable. In 1949, she'd rung up $150,000 in orders and was offered a promotion, distribution rights to the entire state of Florida. In the spring of 1950, she moved south with her son Jerry and her mother. She found a store space, and by May, she'd opened her business and was scouting for new salespeople. Still, not everything was going smoothly. Along with disputes over turf with other distributors, she was constantly contending with botched orders, shipping delays, and product shortages. In March of 1951, Wise had had enough. She called Tupper in a fury. It was the first time they'd spoken, but she was too livid for niceties. She ripped into him immediately. This was hurting not just her bottom line, but also his. Did he not understand how crucial it was that the problems be fixed immediately? Tupper assured her that he'd fix any issues and then asked a favor. He wanted to hear her sales secrets. The next month, the two met at a conference on New York's Long Island, and Wise explained her selling technique. It was pointless, she explained, to think that people would see Tupperware on store shelves or in catalogs and want to buy it. Instead, people had to touch it, squeeze it, drop it, seal it. She gave a bold prescription for saving Tupper's business. Ditch department stores altogether and focus entirely on throwing home parties. Tupper took the advice to heart. So much, in fact, that the day after their meeting, he created a new division just for home parties and asked Wise to be the general manager. In 1952, the first full year of Wise's watch, Tupperware sales rocketed. Wholesale orders exceeded $2 million. During the last half of the year, sales tripled. Tupperware parties did exactly what Wise promised they would, and she became the company's shining star. That year, Tupper gave her a salary of $20,993.33, more than she had ever made. For her birthday in 1953, he presented her with a gold-dyed Palomino horse. Even more remarkably, he gave her the freedom to do practically whatever she wanted. So Wise traveled the country recruiting, presiding over sales conferences, and announcing contests and doling out prizes for incentive. By the looks of it, most of Wise's Tupperware recruits fit neatly into the stereotypical role of a proper housewife. But in reality, they surreptitiously represented a new kind of female empowerment. During World War II, many women had no choice but to enter the workforce. At its end, many of them had no choice but to leave it. Suddenly, selling Tupperware at parties allowed women to straddle both worlds. They were employed, yet they didn't appear to challenge their husband's authority or the status quo. The parties were also a way they could contribute to their family's bottom line. The money, committed dealers could bring in $100 or more per week, was a revelation. The opportunity for success was so great that the husbands of some Tupperware ladies left their own jobs to work with their wives. As Wise became the face of Tupperware, sales and press continued to skyrocket. In 1954, she was the first woman to appear on the cover of Business Week. But as glowing as the magazine's profile was, it contained warning signs about the future of her partnership with Tupper. The piece credited Wise and her sales technique with Tupperware's estimated $25 million in retail sales and seemed to downplay Tupper's role as president of the company he had created. Tupper had never craved the spotlight. In fact, He was known to use the back door of his office to avoid attracting attention. But he was keen to ensure that his product, not an employee, received the lion's share of any attention. The good press continued, but in 1955, after several powerful distributors left the company, sales began to lag. Hard times strained Wise and Tupper's relationship. By 1956, angry letters were flying back and forth between them, and at one point, Tupper stopped taking Wise's calls. Her complaints and frank criticism, previously helpful, had become jabs he couldn't endure. He also started to believe that she was costing him money, irked that she had her own side business selling self-help books at company events. More to the point, he started to suspect that if he tried selling the company, which he was planning to do, having a female executive would get in its way. Finally, in 1958, Tupper flew to Florida and fired Wise. After a heated legal battle, she received only $30,000 as a settlement. She didn't own her house and was ordered to vacate. She had no stock in the company. She didn't even own many of the clothes she wore. The man she'd helped make a millionaire didn't seem to care. Tupper ordered her name expunged from the company history and buried the 600 remaining copies of her book in an unmarked pit behind Tupperware's Florida headquarters. Later that year, he sold the company to Rexall Drug for $16 million, divorced his wife, and bought an island in Central America. He died in Costa Rica in 1983. Wise, on the other hand, tried starting new companies but never achieved the same success she had with Tupperware. She led a quiet life with her horses, pottery, and her son until she died at her home in Kissimmee in 1992. Her influence, however, has not waned. Today, Tupperware is sold in about 100 countries, and every 2.5 seconds, a Tupperware party is held somewhere in the world. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Mental Floss. On the Health and Science page, an antibiotic alternative to killed superbugs. There's new hope in the fight against antibiotic-resistant superbugs, reports the Washington Post. Dutch biotech company Mikrios, announced last week that it had cured 5 out of 6 patients whose skin had been infected with methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, better known as MRSA, a bug that had previously proved immune to even the most powerful antibiotics. Each year, such superbugs cause at least 23,000 deaths and 2 million illnesses in the U.S. alone, and are now threatening to undo more than a century of progress against infectious diseases. Traditional antibiotics need to get inside bacteria to work. But bugs like MRSA, as well as some strains of tuberculosis and salmonella, have adapted to this threat by developing thicker, impenetrable membranes. The new drug, called Staphylococcus, latches onto this outer cell wall and releases an enzyme known as indolysin, which breaks down the membrane and kills the bacteria. Scientists think bacteria won't be able to evolve to defend themselves against the enzyme because indolysin tends to adapt along with its host cell. Unlike conventional antibiotics, the new drug can also be targeted to destroy only harmful bacteria and not the good bacteria that live in and on the human body. The results are exciting, said Dutch microbiologist Jorn Herpers, and demonstrate the potential this technology has to revolutionize the way we treat certain bacterial infections. Glimpsing life after death. Theologians, poets, and scientists have long pondered the mystery of what happens after we die. Does everything fade to black, or can consciousness continue even when the brain stops functioning? The largest ever study of near-death and out-of-body experiences found evidence that consciousness often continues for at least a brief time after death. Scientists at Britain's University of Southampton spent 4 years studying more than 2,000 people who suffered cardiac arrest at 15 hospitals in the UK, US, and Austria. Although the brain typically shuts down within 20 to 30 seconds of cardiac arrest, researchers noted that nearly 40% of those who survived described some form of awareness during the period that their hearts had stopped beating. One patient even recalled leaving his body and observing his resuscitation from across the room and was able to describe the actions of the medical staff in great detail. He seemed very credible, study author Sam Parnia tells the Daily Telegraph. These experiments warrant further investigation. Hummingbirds' beak battles. For male hummingbirds, size does matter. A new University of Connecticut study has revealed that the tiny birds don't just use their long, delicate beaks for slurping nectar. They also use them to stab rivals in the throat and keep them from stealing potential mates. Researchers spent 4 years observing long-billed hermits, a tropical hummingbird species native to Central and South America, and found that adult male birds had the longest, sharpest beaks, which they used to joust with rivals during courtship rituals, said HuffingtonPost.com. The males with the biggest beaks won the most females, which suggests that the bird's famously pointy bill could have evolved in response to competition for mates. Previous theories held that the bills were an adaptation that allowed hummingbirds to sip nectar from elongated flowers. But the study's lead author, Alejandro Rica Guevara, says it's possible that those flowers in fact adapted to fit the male's pointier bills. On the Talking Points page, SEALs, the battle over who shot bin Laden. Who shot Osama bin Laden, asks Peter Greer in CSMonitor.com. Does it matter? 3.5 years after an elite team of Navy commandos known as SEAL Team 6 raided the Al-Qaeda leader's compound in Pakistan, those questions are roiling the secretive world of U.S. special operations. In interviews with Fox News and The Washington Post, former SEAL Rob O'Neill has stepped forward to claim that he fired the fatal shot that killed bin Laden. O'Neill's claim was disputed by other current and former members of Team 6, including Matt Bissonnette, who wrote in his best-selling book that he and another SEAL shot bin Laden at the same time. This tawdry squabbling shows why Navy SEALs are supposed to keep their mouths shut, said Mark Thompson in Time.com. Yes, the bin Laden raid was heroic, but it was built on the backs, boots, and blood of thousands of anonymous troops. No one individual should be taking a victory lap. In military circles, the SEALs are known as the quiet professionals, said Ewan McCaskill in TheGuardian.com. But since their raid on bin Laden's compound in 2011, almost every detail of the operation has been divulged. We know that three of the 23 SEALs who took part made it to bin Laden's third-floor bedroom, said Peter Bergen in CNN.com. O'Neill, Bissonnette, and the point man, who sources say will never in a million years speak publicly about his role. All of them appear to have shot bin Laden, but knowing for certain who actually killed him is impossible. It was a team effort. But why shouldn't O'Neill get some public credit for his heroics? Asked Piers Morgan in dailymail.co.uk. A lot of people have made money out of Rob O'Neill. The highly decorated commando participated in more than 400 combat missions and three Hollywood movies. Captain Phillips, Lone Survivor, and Zero Dark 30 were based on missions O'Neill helped lead. In his memoir, former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta boasted about his own role in the raid, and numerous politicians from President Obama on down took credit for killing bin Laden. Yet after 17 years of valiant service, O'Neill left the military without a pension or health care. He richly deserves the chance to tell his story and make some money. And a few notes as we wind down the hour. The share of registered voters who cast ballots in last week's midterm elections was an estimated 36.6%, the lowest since 1942. In Texas, where a new voter ID law went into effect, voter turnout dropped to 33%, down from 38% in 2010. Violent crime decreased 4.4% in 2013, putting it at the lowest level since 1978. For the first time in American history, there are 100 women sitting in Congress. The milestone was reached when Democrat Alma Adams of North Carolina won a special election to fill a vacant House seat. In the Congress that will be seated in January, there will be at least 101 women in the House and Senate. In Democratic-leaning states, a growing number of parents won't let their sons play high school football out of fear it causes brain damage. The percentage of boys playing football has fallen 15% over the last 6 years in Minnesota and Wisconsin, and 14% in Colorado. Nationwide, only 55% of parents are comfortable with their sons playing football. To date, the American Red Cross has raised just $3.7 million for the Ebola relief effort in West Africa. By comparison, the American Red Cross raised $2.18 billion for Hurricane Katrina relief in 2005 and $312 million following the 2011 earthquake and tsunami in Japan. And a couple of quotes. First from Salvador Dali, "Have no fear of perfection. You'll never reach it." And Albert Einstein with a different approach to a similar idea. Mr. Einstein says, "Failure is success in progress." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.